In the days leading up to the insurrection, the former president's allies devised a plan to use a warped interpretation of the 1887 Electoral Count Act. There's now bipartisan support, by the way, for reforming the stupid 1887 Electoral Count Act to clarify that the vice president does not have unbridled power to discount electors.
No, he doesn't. And yes, the act is really stupid.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN. In Palenville, New York on WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and all of your favorite podcast sites that do not include Spotify. We're not on Spotify, are we, Disney?
No, we are not.
We are not on Spotify. So there you go. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Well, given the pressure on then-Vice President Mike Pence on January 6, 2021, to use his role overseeing Congress's largely ceremonial affirmation of the Electoral College votes that were already certified in all 50 states by then, and the fake electors for Donald Trump, who in as many as seven states had falsely declared themselves to be, quote, duly elected by the people of their states. They hadn't, and it may have been a criminal act to have said so, and it's now being investigated by the Department of Justice, reportedly. Given all of that, Mike Pence went out of his way to make clear when opening the Electoral College votes on January 6, 2021 from each of the states that the parliamentarian in Congress had double-checked with each state to make sure that the slate of electors Congress was to certify was, in fact, the slate elected by each of the states. Now, normally the vice president in modern times, whether it was Joe Biden or Dick Cheney, they all sort of said that the same general text over and over again whenever they began this ceremony to count the electoral votes in a joint session of Congress. Here's what it sounded like when Joe Biden did it.
After ascertainment has been had that certificates are authentic and correct in form, the tellers will count and make a list of the votes cast by the electors.
That's it. Pretty simple.
Yeah, it's the same script every time.
And few noticed at the time, but Mike Pence added very specific language to mention that he had checked with the parliamentarian to make sure that the votes were true and accurate, which no previous modern-day vice president serving as president of the Senate overseeing the Electoral College vote affirmation in the constitutionally mandated process in this joint session of Congress, no vice president had ever said words like this before.
After ascertaining that the certificates are regular in form and authentic, the tellers will announce the votes cast by the electors for each state, beginning with Alabama, which the parliamentarians advised me is the only certificate of vote from that state and purports to be a return from the state that has annexed to it a certificate from an authority of that state purporting to appoint or ascertain electors.
Wow, that's a whole lot of words.
Yeah.
And this was, like I said, it was never done before, and few noticed it at the time. I didn't notice it, but all of that, as we had reported in detail at the time, prior to January 6th, when many media outlets were looking elsewhere, oh, who's Joe Biden going to nominate for this or that? That extra bunch of words that Mike Pence added there, saying that the parliamentarian actually checked with the states, and this is the certified one from the proper person who's supposed to certify it in each state. All of that was done thanks to the vagaries of the 135-year-old Electoral Count Act, which, along with several less-than-clear clauses in the U.S. Constitution itself, opened the door up to the mischief that was wrought by Team Trump to try to exploit those vagaries in order to simply steal the 2020 election before our very eyes. Now, as you know, thanks to Mike Pence's unwillingness to play along with that scheme and a bunch of members of Congress who were subsequently spooked by Trump's deadly attack on the Capitol that day, American democracy and its process for selecting a president with a peaceful transfer of power ultimately worked out essentially as it was supposed to, but at an obviously huge cost in lives at the Capitol and much else. To that end, a bipartisan group in the U.S. Senate is now working to reform and to clarify the horribly written Electoral Count Act of 1887 to try and prevent at least some of the confusion and mischief and mayhem that Team Trump tried to exploit last time. They're trying to avoid that with a rewrite of the ECA. But as my guest joining me shortly, literally from the U.S. Senate gallery, where she's covering this effort closely, as she reports, even a reform of the ECA may not be able to prevent a rogue political party, particularly at the state level, from outright stealing the next presidential election if they decide to act in blatant bad faith. What? Republicans acting in blatant bad faith? What's the likelihood of that? And if they do, there may be nothing to actually stop them, as my recurring nightmares keep reminding me. Particularly what she describes in her reporting on this as the swing state governor's gambit. We will explain all of that shortly today. But first, speaking of the Senate, New Mexico's Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan, it was announced last night after we got off the air, has been hospitalized for a stroke. But according to a statement from his office, the 49-year-old senator is expected to make a full recovery.
Oh, good.
Last week, after he started experiencing dizziness and fatigue, the statement said he checked himself into a hospital. Lujan was found to have suffered a stroke affecting his balance. As part of his treatment plan, he subsequently underwent decompressive surgery to ease swelling on his cerebellum. So this was a serious issue. I know that Democrats are sort of kind of trying to downplay it right now, but this was serious business. While he recovers, there will be only 49 members available to vote in the Senate Democratic Caucus, underscoring, just in case any of you needed a reminder, just how tenuous the party's Senate majority currently is, at least as long as they have 50 senators who can show up and vote and Vice President Kamala Harris to break any ties there. But of course, that is only for stuff that can be passed with a majority vote. Most of the stuff in the Senate still requires 60 votes in order to break a filibuster, with Republicans essentially filibustering anything that they can, given that Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refused any reform of the filibuster, even to pass democracy laws on a straight, small-D Democratic majority vote. Even after Republicans killed the Senate filibuster in order to seat lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court under Donald Trump, packing the court with three of his nominees that way. Democrats may be unable to fill the seat being vacated by Justice Stephen Breyer unless they can get all 50 senators to show up in good health in order to vote to seat whoever Biden's nominee is with their 50 vote plus Kamala Harris for 51 votes majority. Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, a member of Senate leadership, she was candid with reporters on Tuesday about the precariousness of the bare Senate majority for Democrats being thrown into sharp relief by Lujan's illness. Quote, "That's just what we live with every day in a 50-50 Senate," she said. "Something could happen to someone at any time." Lujan, at 49, is incredibly young by Senate standards. The median age is 64.3 years old. Stabenow added that she doesn't expect Lujan's recovery to disrupt the SCOTUS confirmation process, however, pointing to the time that it will take to get a nominee through the process. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said later in the day on Tuesday, "We look forward to Lujan's speedy return to the Senate, and I believe the Senate will be able to carry forward in its business," he said. Well, let's hope so, and let's hope that no one else falls ill on the Democratic side or decides to, jump ship.
Well, that would be bad.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Yes, with so many Democratic senators, too, that are in their 80s now, it really does underscore that there is no one to spare.
Of course, if they lost the Democrat one way or another through illness or jumping ship, that would, of course, put Republican Mitch McConnell immediately back in charge of the U.S. Senate with a Republican majority there. While we're on the Senate, there were two things that I had discussed several times during the months-long sausage-making process regarding Joe Biden's Build Back Better Act, before Joe Manchin finally pulled his vote at the end of last year, killing the very popular provisions in the $1.7 trillion measure that would have expanded health care, reduced health care costs. It would have expanded child care, elder care, education, paid parental leave. It would have lowered, health care premiums, expanded the child care tax credit that had lifted about 50% of the nation's kids out of poverty over the past year, following the provision that was included in Biden's American Rescue Plan, which, by the way, not a single Republican voted for. Not to mention, it also included the landmark $555 billion in spending to tackle climate change for the first time at the federal level. So two things I had mentioned on several occasions about the Build Back Better bill. One, that it seemed like Joe Manchin was actually hoping to kill the bill all along by pretending that he supported it, but he just couldn't tolerate this provision or that or the overall amount of money that was being spent, even though the bill was fully paid for. Unlike the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill that he took the lead in actually passing in the Senate, that wasn't fully paid for. And then the other thing, number two, was that Joe Manchin did not want to see its climate provisions adopted, I had argued several times, given his personal family ownership of a coal firm, a coal supply firm. What does it do exactly, this coal business of his?
It's called a waste coal, and it basically literally clears out the waste coal from old coal mines and sells it to there's only one plant, turns out, one plant in West Virginia that Manchin's family's waste coal business sells to.
Interesting.
And throughout his career, he has, as governor of West Virginia, he has made all kinds of changes to the law in order to ensure that one plant stays open.
So if that one plant gets shut down, that kind of knocks out his entire family business?
It kind of does, yes. Now, he's passed it on, the control of that company, EnerSystems, to his son, but he does pull in about $500,000 a year personally
on that. Yes, he's passed control to his son, so he's got nothing to do with it other than, making $500,000 a year from it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Build Back Better Act would arguably you know, hurt his family business and his family fortunes if that thing was passed and included all of the provisions that would have helped move us from dirty fossil fuels to clean renewable energy. And everyone has been pretending like, oh, Joe Manchin agreed with the provisions in the bill for that. So those two things, his interest, I always thought, in wanting to kill it, and his not wanting to see the climate provisions passed, or the combination of those two things that very well may have been related, I had talked about several times over the past several months. And yet still, he kept claiming that the climate stuff in there was one of the things in the bill that he really, really wanted to see passed, even after he had killed the bill at the end of last year. There was talk that he might be able to pass the climate provisions and a few other things and a smaller chunk of things that Manchin totally, definitely supported. Call me cynical, but I think it is well documented here that I never bought that crap. And yes. At least, you know, I've been incredibly dubious about it. Let's just say that. Now, here's this today from TPM's Kate Riga. What Build Back Better bill? Said Joe Manchin incredulously when asked by reporters Tuesday about progress on the legislation. I don't know what you're all talking about, he continued. No. That bill is dead, he said. And with that, Manchin drove a spike into the heart of President Joe Biden's signature legislation, which he had already shot down late last year. After dragging negotiations out for months, he left the bargaining table back in December, later citing his anger with how he'd been treated by White House staffers, poor dear. Now, how did they treat him poorly? You may recall at one point the White House, in a statement, mentioned Joe Manchin's name, saying that they were working hard with him to negotiate the bill's final provisions. They didn't attack him. They said they were working hard together to get this through to passage. While Riga reports that these comments from Manchin this week don't entirely preclude the possibility of reassembling some of the pieces of the package that Manchin supported into a new bill. She says he indicated to reporters later on Tuesday that he remains open to potential future work. Sure he does. Touching on the issues in the reconciliation package, he specifically mentioned raising taxes on the wealthy and lowering prescription drug costs, which happened to be the two provisions of the bill that Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona had vetoed. Oh, darn the luck. The two things he mentioned that he wanted, well, the other obstructionist Democrat in the Senate doesn't want them. And apparently, he forgot to mention those climate provisions that he used to pretend to really, really support.
Oopsie.
But he made clear that the comprehensive bill as it was written is, quote, gone. When asked by reporters about other provisions that he once supported in Build Back Better, he ended the conversation. A varied group of House Democrats gathered on Monday to emphasize the importance of the climate provisions in the reconciliation package and to lobby for moving forward with something that somehow keeps them intact. Well, good luck, House Democrats, with that. I do hope I am completely wrong, but I must say I never bought the idea that Joe Manchin was ever going to let $500 billion worth of environmental action, clean, efforts to move from dirty fossil fuels on which his family makes millions to clean renewable energy. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, leader of the Progressive Caucus in the House, said late last week that her conversations with Manchin post blow up last year have led her to believe that there are still pieces of the package that he does want to pass. But meanwhile, the Senate has pivoted on to other legislative priorities in the meantime. After Manchin, assisted by Sinema, stymied Democrats' hopes of passing voting legislation as well, momentum has now turned to a different election reform proposal that may garner Republican support. Enough of them to overcome a GOP filibuster And can Joe Manchin himself even be counted on to support it? And will it do all that it is supposed to do, like prevent a rogue, bad faith party from stealing a presidential election in 2024 or beyond? We will pick up those questions and many more with Business Insider's Grace Panetta, who has been covering this new legislative effort in the Senate. She joins us next from a hopefully quiet spot in the U.S. Senate gallery, I think. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. You may be able to count on me, but you might not be able to count on Congress when it comes to counting the next presidential election, the next Electoral College results. As you know by now, after vowing to pardon the insurrectionists who attacked the Capitol in hopes of helping him steal the 2020 election on January 6, 2021, and now calling for mass protests in the streets should he be indicted in any of the many criminal probes our disgraced, twice impeached former president is now facing in Washington, D.C., New York, and Georgia, and who knows where else. Donald Trump went on then to top off his weekend on Sunday with a statement charging that, quote, Democrats and rhino Republicans like wacky Susan Collins are desperately trying to pass legislation that will not allow the vice president to change the results of the election. Claiming that, quote, actually what they are saying is that Mike Pence did have the right to change the outcome and they now want to take that right away. He added that Pence, quote, could have overturned the election. Well, no, he couldn't, at least according to most legitimate legal and constitutional law experts, and certainly not according to longstanding traditions and norms, even if those traditions and norms are based on rather vague century-old laws and even vaguer clauses in the U.S. Constitution itself. While Trump's statement on Sunday has led many to charge, correctly, that he is admitting here out loud that he was never actually trying to pause the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory in Congress to allow for more time to collect evidence of imaginary election fraud, he was, in fact, simply trying to have his vice president, Mike Pence, in his role as Senate president, simply steal the election from the voters who elected Joe Biden. But what he's referring to in his remarks, that statement on Sunday about Republicans and Democrats desperately trying to pass legislation that will not allow the vice president to change the results of the election, that is a reference to a new bipartisan effort reportedly now underway in the U.S. Senate to rewrite the vague, poorly written Electoral Count Act, or ECA, of 1887. That act and its vagaries, along with some arguably even vaguer clauses in the U.S. Constitution, is part of what I have referred to more than once on this program as the stuff that quite literally has been keeping me up at night as I run through in my brain all of the many ways that a party, in this case Republicans, choosing to not act in good faith could, in fact, pretty easily steal an American presidential election before our very eyes, no matter how voters may have voted at the state level, and the fact that there are essentially no measures in place to prevent that from happening. In short, I, at least, have been unable to come up with any way to protect against a bad faith effort by a political party to simply, quote unquote, legally given our current laws, steal a presidential election if they decided to act in concert in bad faith. A rewrite of the 130-year-old Electoral Count Act, depending on how it goes, depending if it can actually be passed in this evenly divided Senate, would go some way towards making that a bit harder to pull off. But even that, as Business Insider's senior politics reporter Grace Panetta spelled out in a deep dive piece this week, may not block every avenue from a bad faith effort by Republicans to steal the next presidential election in 2024 or beyond if they decide to do so. As Panetta opens her smart article this week, she writes, Congress first passed the Electoral Count Act, or ECA, following the disputed 1876 election between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes, which was marred by allegations of fraud and the disenfranchisement of black voters. But as former President Donald Trump continues to relentlessly push his false claims of a fraudulent presidential election and openly says it should have been, quote, overturned, some members of Congress want to revise the 19th century law. The proposed reforms to the ECA are designed to prevent the executive branch and Congress from undermining elections, as Trump and dozens of Republican members of Congress tried to do by raising objections to the results at the state level in Arizona and Pennsylvania on January 6, and pressuring former Vice President Pence to overturn the ratification of then-candidate Joe Biden's Electoral College victory, leading, of course, to the deadly insurrection at the Capitol. However, the suggested changes, she writes, to the law would do little to constrain the power of state and local governments. That, Panetta warns, would allow a pathway for a rogue governor in a swing state like Georgia to single-handedly undermine that democratic process. Well, that does not sound helpful. Joining us now to elucidate this warning from the U.S. Senate gallery, as I understand it, is Business Insider senior politics reporter Grace Panetta. Grace, thank you for joining us on the broadcast, as I know things are heating up there on your beat on Capitol Hill with the Senate now back in session and the scramble to get something done on this matter and others this week. So thank you for taking time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Brad.
Before we get to the reforms and the problems that you see in those reforms, potentially, as you report at Insider, even if the ECA is rewritten at the federal level, what is the Electoral Count Act of 1887 as it currently supposed to do, and how is it supposed to avoid the problems that occurred in the contested 1876 election between Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes?
Yeah, so before the Electoral Count Act, it was really just 12th Amendment that laid out how after the Electoral College votes, Congress should count the votes. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the 12th Amendment is almost entirely written in the passive voice and is really unclear, just says the presiding officer, the envelopes will be counted, mm-hmm. and it has no provisions laying out what to do if, for example, multiple authorities purporting to be representing a state send multiple slates of electors, which was the case in that disputed 1876 election. Mm-hmm. So the Electoral Count Act kind of emerged as sort of a makeshift compromise solution to try to put some more guardrails into the process, clarify Congress's vote counting procedures and authorities, and also tell Congress what to do if a similar situation occurs where you have multiple slates of electors purporting to be from the same state.
And how did Trump then attempt to exploit the vagaries of the ECA, and it is really confusing, as you note. One legal scholar you spoke to pointed out, and I hadn't realized this. I've read the act, but I hadn't realized this. The expert said many of its substantive rules are set out in one single sentence that is 275 words long. So how did Trump and his supporters, like Attorney John Eastman and others, try to use that confusion in their effort to try and steal the 2020 election?
Yeah, so Trump and his allies did a few things. They not only exploited the vagueness in the Electoral Count Act, but other unclear provisions of federal law that date back to the 19th century, and also just the Electoral College system in general. At the state level, they tried to get Republican state legislatures to send in slates of electors for Trump, so that that would trigger a multiple slate scenario that Congress would then have to figure out. No Republican state legislatures did that, although there were some sort of rogue slates just from Trump supporters that had no legal authority whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then they also tried to exploit sort of the vagueness around the vice president's role. Of course, the ECA, as written, does not give the vice president the authority to unilaterally decide which electoral votes to count or not. But what John Eastman did is try to tell Pence, you know, the ECA is unconstitutional, just disregard it and assert your authority under the 12th Amendment to decide which votes to count or not. And then you overturn the election. So easy. So it was really sort of this perfect storm of both exploiting vague provisions, but also really just trampling over the Constitution and the law as it exists.
In one of his insane statements this week, our disgraced former president said that the bipartisan House Select Committee examining the January 6 insurrection and Trump's attempt to steal the election should focus on, quote, why Mike Pence did not send back the votes for recertification or approval, in that it has now been shown that he clearly had the right to do so. It is this attempt in the Senate to reform the ECA that Trump is using here, is referring to in that statement, to try and say that the reform of the 135-year-old statute is somehow an acknowledgement that it was previously written to allow a vice president to toss out or overturn results. So, A, just for clarity, was it? And B, I'm wondering if the folks working to rewrite it now on Capitol Hill have given comment in response to you to that particular claim on Sunday by Trump.
Yes, yeah, so I think a really important thing to clarify here is that the ECA, as it exists, you know, as it's an imperfect, flawed form, does not give the vice president this authority. At the same time, however, I think what both the bipartisan group are doing and another trio of Democratic senators who actually introduced an ECA reform bill yesterday morning are trying to do is just even more clearly state and clearly clarify in 21st century language that once single slates of electors sent to Congress, you know, should be treated as final, and that the vice president really has no role to adjudicate this. And I do think that Trump's comments did sort of increase the urgency behind all of these efforts to really clarify this in statute.
And so you mentioned this this bipartisan group of 16 senators, another effort by three Democrats, or two Democrats and one independent, Angus King. What are they now hoping to do here with their rewrite? How are they hoping to reform or rewrite the 1887 version of the ECA to clarify these matters? What are the sort of the bullet points that they're trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, so that bill introduced yesterday morning, and they call it the Electoral Count Modernization Act, and it does address efforts to overturn elections at the state level and in Congress. And, you know, a few election scholars I've talked to and have seen writing about it, you know, agree that it's a good place to start with this. And so it's basically clarifying federal law to make it harder for state legislatures, for example, to step in and appoint alternate slates of electors, which Trump argued for them to do, make it harder for example, a state official to send in a fraudulent slate of electors, and creating ways for candidates to sue in court to make sure that the slate of electors that reflects the votes in the states is the one sent to Congress, and then also constraining Congress's ability to object to slates of electors by raising, for example, the threshold to bring an objection to a vote, because right now it's just one member of the House and one member of the Senate, and clarifying the vice president's role.
And it's one member of the House, one member of the Senate to challenge any particular state, and then they go into their respective chambers in the Senate and the House, and they eventually vote on whether to accept those electors or not. And it's done by currently a majority vote. This would, as I understand it, change it to a supermajority or two-thirds majority to uphold such an objection. So that's in the House. I'm sorry, in the House and the Senate, in Congress. But here's where, you know, we get to my continuing nightly nightmares, Grace Panetta. You write that a determined, depending on how this is rewritten, you write that a determined state governor or legislature would still be able to help steal a presidential election anyway, even if the ECA is successfully written at the federal level, I guess depending on its how it's written, and arguably that such a rewrite could actually make it even easier for them to do at the state level. How so?
Yeah, so, and this is sort of the case with everything. There are costs and benefits in all of these cases when looking at it. And one of the risks here in this situation is that by constraining Congress, making it harder for members of Congress to object to counting, especially just single slates of electors, if that's the only slate coming from a state, to make it harder to object to that, since that's what we saw on January 6th. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think sort of the argument I was making is that these efforts that Trump tried in 2020 are now the groundwork is being laid at the state level for mm-hmm. state officials like governors, like secretaries of state, to overturn elections. Mm-hmm. And one of the legal expert, who's the main voice in the piece, essentially argued that, in short, a governor could submit a illegitimate slate of electors that does not reflect the popular vote in the state, and candidates could try in federal court to compel a governor to send the correct slate, but it's no guarantee that that would, you know, fully work, and then that could end up in Congress. And the Electoral Count Act, as written, directs Congress to prioritize slates of electors signed by governors, mm-hmm. therefore creating an opportunity, especially for manipulation by governors who have that sort of privilege under the ECA.
And this is where this all gets really quite terrifying. You cite Yale Law School's Matt Seligman. He argues that making it harder for Congress's objections to slates of voters could actually, quote, be really dangerous, given mm-hmm. the political conditions now brewing at the state level, meaning the political conditions in places like Arizona, for example. I think there was a bill that has been introduced to essentially allow an up or down vote by the state legislature to decide if they accept or not the results of the state's presidential elections. And so, for example, if they said, no, we don't accept Joe Biden's victory here, we're going to send Trump electors to Congress, now it would actually be harder for Congress to block those bogus electors in Congress, depending on how this is rewritten, correct?
Yes, depending on how it's rewritten, if you state, you know, Congress can't question just a single slate of electors that comes out of a state, then yeah, that does increase the risk of manipulation and subversion by governors and create sort of that perverse incentive mm-hmm. for them to submit rogue electors.
And that's the what Seligman describes as the swing state governor's gambit. That is really the case right now, even before any changes to the ECA, right? A rogue governor, if they decide, nope, I just don't accept these, I'm not going to sign these electors, I'm going to send the other electors or send nobody at all. It's really up to one person. If they decide they want to throw an election, one governor in one swing state, depending on the results elsewhere, could really steal an election, couldn't they?
Yeah, basically, as of right now, there's that path forward because of how much power the governors have in our political system and specifically in the Electoral College. And I think that's what really this all comes down to, is the Electoral College system and sort of the realities of current law allow for this. To happen.
And so how can this be rewritten to prevent nightmares like that, like the swing state governor's gambit? Is there a way to do that? Do the current efforts that you have been reporting on closely in the Senate and in the House actually take on these concerns and offer fixes? Is there a way that this can be fixed at the federal level?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as everything, this is an exercise in risk management and risk mitigation, right? So it's impossible to eliminate, you know, any risks at the state level. But for example, the draft bill released yesterday by Senators Klobuchar, King, and Durbin mm-hmm. does anticipate this rogue governor scenario and create a federal cause of action or a way in the courts for candidates to sue to compel governors to submit the slates of electors that reflect the popular votes in the state. So it creates, you know, that judicial review and puts the judiciary as a check on that. Of course, a governor could still defy that order. So there's only so much federal law can do. But explicitly creating that cause of action is sort of the first step, and that does, you know, guard against this scenario.
So in this case, if there was a challenge to the results, they would be able to go to someone, and I'm not sure who, voters, a candidate would be able to go to the judiciary, go to the courts and say, hey, they are not, you know, I won the election according to the evidence, but they are not awarding me the electors. Go to state court or federal court? How would that work? Do we know yet?
Yeah, so it would be in federal court. It would be in federal court that candidates would go to sue, essentially ask a court to compel a state official, a governor in this case, to submit the slate of electors that represents popular vote. And now there are some scholars who are already criticizing that section and think it's a little confusing and should be clarified. But that's the basic idea, right, is to give candidates a cause of action, a pathway in court to compel a state official to submit the correct slate of electors.
Well, as long as it doesn't have any single sentences that are more than 275 words long, I guess we'll be okay. But this does, you know, send the matter. If you go to federal court, that works its way up, of course, to Donald Trump's Supreme Court. Now, they have ruled against him in the past, but now we're essentially ruling, we're essentially counting now on federal courts to do the right thing.
Yes, we are. And this, you know, just highlights the importance of the judiciary. And, you know, when I talked to Matthew Seligman, that's one of the things he said. He acknowledged the courts aren't perfect, but he said, you know, it's either the courts or the Speaker of the House or a governor who are all partisan officials. It depends on which actor you want making that final decision.
Because right now it's really no one. It's really chaos. It's really the loudest voice in one sense. One of the reasons that Democratic leadership in Congress was lukewarm originally to working too much on the ECA previously, as I understand it, is that they feared it was going to take focus from the attempt to pass the critical Freedom to Vote Act and John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that were eventually scuttled when Lord Manchin and Lady Sinema refused to reform the Senate filibuster's 60-vote threshold to pass both of those bills. How has the apparent, and I would add shameful, end to the effort to pass those two bills, for the time being anyway, led us to ECA reform? And why are Republicans now willing to work on this, but not one would work would vote for either the Freedom to Vote or the John Lewis Act?
Yeah, so to your first question, I think the failure of those big voting rights bills was sort of kind of like the final straw. It was the last thing really the Democratic leadership could do after Manchin and Sinema voted down those changes to the filibuster. That was really the end of the line, and it clearly established that any bill, any election-related bill, needs to get 60 votes, so 10 Republicans in the Senate. And I think that was what finally stirred up more of the impetus to reform the Electoral Count Act. And to your second question, I think how Republicans see it is they saw those two big voting rights bills, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis bill, as kind of a federal takeover, the federal government, you know, reaching into states and, you know, imposing too many restrictions. Of course, Congress has the authority to regulate federal elections under the Elections Clause, and they have many times in the past. But I think this Electoral Count Act and broader election reform thing is a bit different, because especially with the ECA, it's not so much about imposing new restrictions, but kind of reining in the power of Congress, the power of the state-level officials, and clarifying the power of the vice president. And, of course, Kamala Harris is going to be the one presiding over the Electoral Count in 2025. We don't know which party is going to control Congress in the future, so it's almost like this veil of ignorance that is creating a little bit more incentive for both parties to want to just apply more guardrails to this system, I think, is what's happening.
Because now Kamala Harris could, if she has the right to determine whoever she wants to be the winner, I guess now they have some concern. Are there some items that, you know, because there was sort of this chicken and egg thing, you know, a lot of folks have said, we, you know, no need to reform, no use in reforming the ECA to make sure the right winner is elected if people aren't allowed to vote in the first place, which is what, you know, Freedom to Vote and the John Lewis Act were meant to deal with. That's true going in both directions. Are some items from the Freedom to Vote and John Lewis Act making their way into this ECA reform?
Yeah, they're definitely being discussed. They're definitely in the mix, particularly the provisions in the bill about adding more federal protections against harassment and intimidation of election workers. That's something that at least one, the Republican leading this bipartisan effort, Susan Collins, has expressed interest and including potentially in a bipartisan package. But other than that, I don't think we're going to see a lot of the same, for example, mandates to offer certain voting options that were in those bills, or particularly anything restoring the parts of the Voting Rights Act that have been struck down or weakened by the Supreme Court. But I definitely think the protections for election workers and more funding for elections are two things that have the greatest chance from that big bill of making it into a bipartisan elections package.
And you you noted there are several efforts working right now on this reform, as you reported yesterday at both Insider and on Twitter. A 16-member bipartisan group led by Democrat Joe Manchin, oy, and Republican Susan Collins, double oy, as well as a draft put out yesterday by the Democrats, Senators Klobuchar, Independent Angus King, and Democrat Dick Durbin. Should we actually trust Joe Manchin, much less Susan Collins, this time to actually see this bill through to completion? And what should we put the odds at right now, I guess, of this package actually getting through both houses and to the president's desk?
Yeah, I'm always skeptical about putting numbers, numerical figures to predictions. But I think this whole time, both Senators Manchin and Collins have expressed legitimate, genuine, good faith interest in doing something. Whether or not they can come up with something that all 16 members of this working group can agree to, much less 60 senators from both parties, remains to be seen. But I do get the sense that they're legitimately interested in this. Manchin, of course, is a former Secretary of State and governor. And that's, you know, always been his guiding principle, is bipartisanship and getting things done in a bipartisan way. So I think it's more a question of what they can get their colleagues to agree to.
Yeah, no, exactly, because you note that Republican Senators Collins and Murkowski are part of this 16-member working group. But how many other Republicans are there in that group? Because by my count, at least 10 of them, 10 Republicans would have to come on board to overcome a filibuster, undoubtedly of Trump supporters, who I'm guessing would love to block this reform. How many Republicans are currently on board with this effort?
Yeah, so as far as I know, the latest figure is there are 9 of them in this working group. So Collins, Murkowski, Senator Mitt Romney, Tom Tillis, Joni Ernst, Shelley Moore Capito, also from West Virginia, Rob Portman, Ben Sasse, Roger Wicker, and Todd Young are also in these talks.
Nice. Nice. Okay, so we're almost there. Got 9 of them, need just one more. That's good news, as long as we don't lose any Democratic senators along the way. Really appreciate your reporting on this, Grace. I think it's really important. I think it's so much more important that people actually understand, because it's such an opaque, you know, 135-year-old law, the Electoral Count Act, the Constitution itself is vague on this. But obviously, it was not confusing to Donald Trump in that he was able to put all his eggs sort of into this basket to try to steal an election. I don't think there's any reason to believe he or his supporters wouldn't try to do it again if given the chance. Grace, I hope you'll come back and talk to us more as this moves forward, and to let us know if they've closed off the various avenues that you warn about, that you report about in your deep dive at Business Insider, headlined "How a Rogue Governor Could Steal the Next Presidential Election for Trump." Grace Panetta, really appreciate you joining us. You can find her work at on the Twitters at Grace_Panetta and, of course, on the web at businessinsider.com. Grace Panetta, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Brad. It's really great to talk to you.
And to you. All right, quick break, and we've got some good news.
Oh, good.
I think. Some good news. You may or may not agree with me that it's good news. We will find out coming up right after this break. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Our nightmare election may be over, but new ones are on the way. Here at The Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
It's up to you, New York, New York.
Yes, it is. Welcome back. to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, as I said, some of you may see this as good news. Some of you may not. I know there's a lot of Democrats and progressives out there who were critical, who are being critical about this today, but I am not. As you know, I have been calling on Democrats to do everything they can, democratically controlled states, to do everything they can in order to save American democracy, not in order to save Democrats, but to save American democracy, to, yes, redistrict following this 2020 census, to create maps that, well, give an advantage, if possible, to Democrats. And now this, Democrats across the nation have spent years railing against partisan gerrymandering, particularly in Republican states, most recently trying to pass federal voting rights legislation in Washington to all but disallow the practice. And it would have disallowed it in all 50 states, but for Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. But as the New York Times notes this afternoon, given the same opportunity for the first time in decades, Democratic lawmakers in New York adopted on Wednesday an aggressive reconfiguration of the state's congressional districts that positions the party to flip three seats in the U.S. House this year, a greater shift than projected in any other state. As Bloomberg reports, New York would have fewer Republican-leaning congressional districts under legislation passed by the state legislature on Wednesday. The proposed U.S. House district map would maximize Democratic Party prospects by building in an advantage in as many as 22 of the 26 newly drawn districts. The state's map-making process has been closely watched because of its potential impact on control of Congress. The speakership of Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Party's five-seat U.S. House majority, and the ability of President Joe Biden to get his agenda enacted at all will be on the line in the November elections. Both parties have been using their state house clout around the nation to create a national advantage. Democrats dominate in New York with supermajority control of the legislature, where the bill was passed in the assembly yesterday and by the state Senate today. The measure now heads to Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, who will have the final say on these maps. Republicans have vigorously objected to the proposal, accusing Democrats of aggressive gerrymandering.
Oh, dear. The horror.
Right?
I know.
They're furious. They are. Former U.S. Congressman John Faso, who has been a Republican leader in the assembly, said, quote, "I think the proposal is illegal under the state constitution. It clearly violates the prohibition on partisan gerrymandering." Well, you know what? Fine. Good. Take it to court and find out. Take it to state court, by the way, to find out. Maybe you will be right. You won't be able to take it to your stolen and packed U.S. Supreme Court, however, because they recently determined that federal courts may not take any action whatsoever when it comes to partisan gerrymanders. Republican Assemblyman Mark Walsick said on the assembly floor, quote, "This redistricting scheme is one-party tyranny, and it is dead wrong," he said. Meanwhile, Republicans are in charge of redrawing more congressional districts nationwide than Democrats, and they have tried to do exactly this in state after state after state. They are being challenged in state court, and by the way, they are losing. The Democrats may lose in New York. I don't know. I don't know the state constitution that well. You know, and I know that there are a lot of, nonpartisan gerrymandering, redistricting experts, I should say, who we've had on this show before, including David Lee from the Brennan Center, who is not
Michael Lee from the Brennan Center, who was against it. You know, he said it doesn't necessarily redound to the Democrats' benefit to act like Republicans and gerrymander like that.
Well, he's wrong. No, I listen, he's got his opinions on this, and I know a lot of people out there have their own opinions about this. They think that Democrats should not do what Republicans have done for years.
And are doing right now. I mean, Texas Republicans just gerrymandered out of existence the only black majority district in the state.
Yeah. And so, you know, I understand how people may feel there, and I felt that way myself for many years. I've only changed my tune on this because at this point, given some of the stuff that we just discussed there with Grace Panetta about the Electoral Count Act and how Republicans are planning, if they can get back a majority in either or both chambers of Congress, how they are planning, hoping to game potentially the next presidential election, to steal it if they have the opportunity. I think nothing, frankly, is more important for American democracy. Forget about Democrats. For American democracy itself, to ensure that Democrats hold on to majority control in at least one of the two chambers of Congress in order to prevent a stolen presidential election. So, listen, I was also in favor of the Freedom to Vote Act, which would have outlawed partisan gerrymandering in all 50 states. I am perfectly fine with outlawing it everywhere, but unilaterally disarming, while we're seeing Republicans do this now in state after state after state, as they did back in 2011 after the 2010 census. You know, in states like Ohio, which is, you know, pretty much 50-50, or North Carolina, which has been pretty much 50-50 in statewide elections now for the past decade, and yet they have these huge, not even close advantages that they've given to Republicans in the congressional delegations in those states. Yeah, those are being challenged in courts, and they should. And so far, at least in Ohio, they're not doing well with the gerrymandering. But if that's the way they're going to play, I don't know why anyone should be willing to unilaterally disarm at this point, not with American democracy itself on the line.
Yeah, unilateral disarmament in this case would be suicide for American democracy.
In New York, there's been the additional complications of the state losing a congressional seat as a result of the 2020 census. Democrats hold 19 of the current 27 districts. The new maps would give them an edge in 22 of 26 districts. Kelly Burton, the president of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, said in an email, the 2020 census made it clear that Democrats were going to pick up seats and Republicans were going to lose seats in New York, which is consistent with the state's population growth over the past decade. Unlike what they did in Texas, where a majority of the population, they actually picked up seats thanks to minority population growth in the state, and yet minorities lost seats the way they've redrawn the maps there. Burton said this draft map reflects that growth, unlike the Republican maps in states like Texas, Ohio, North Carolina, where the growing urban and suburban communities actually lost representation. So there is what I will call good news for now. If you disagree, you can drop me email and let me know. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. Our thanks today to my guest, Business Insider's Grace Panetta, to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. You can download this show or any other for free anytime at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who support our work at bradblog.com/donate. You can also find me between here and the next time we meet on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. I'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
It's up to you, New York.